That was Alan talking about the fields of worldviews. And I guess that's what we're going to kind of focus in on today. There's the next video as well. We'll not watch it for the sake of time, but we're going to look at, in the time that we have, we're going to look at the mistakes that you have in worldviews, and we're going to look at how Christianity actually avoids those things. We're going to look at how Christianity has the answers to avoid those failures. So as Alan said, we're talking about building on solid foundations. And of course, we've been learning about who we are as a church in Ephesians. Christ is our cornerstone. We know that he is our firm foundation. And we know that in everything, don't we, that we're unshakable. We're sure and steadfast in our hope. So then we ask of the other worldviews, well, are you? And we can say, we know you're not. So let's kind of like think of those four things that Alan mentioned. Let's think about them a little bit deeper and see how we can see those in everyday life of other worldviews and see how we actually are secure in them. So first of all, as he said, a worldview cannot infinitely regress. So regress is like the opposite of progress. Regress is, it's backing itself into a corner. It's infinitely backing on up. It's infinitely reversing. And I guess just as a really simple example of this, it's that kind of classic question that is posed. Well, what came first? Was it the chicken or the egg? And of course, we think that's a silly question, don't we? Because we're like, well, God created the chicken, obviously. But if you don't have creation, the question has been posed historically, well, what did come first? Is it fair to say that all chickens that are born come out of eggs? Is that a fair statement? Is it fair to say that all eggs that exist come from chickens? Are those two statements true? If so, what came first? The chicken or the egg? Which one was at the beginning? And so we look at that in secularism. And I've titled this Big Bangs and Sparks of Life, because I think two of the most prominent questions where that comes up with infinite regress is, okay, well, where did we come from? Well, the universe was created in a big bang. That's the theory, isn't it? And you say, okay, well, where did the big bang come from? And we say, well, there were a collision of two massively excited, like energy-filled superparticles collided, and the resultant energy expanded, created the universe as we know it. That's the answer. So then you ask, okay, well, where did these supercharged particles come from? And I don't know if their science suggests answers beyond that, but certainly that's what I learned when I was studying. And there comes a point when there is no answer. It's like, well, something came before it, because time, you know, what happened at the beginning of time? Was there a beginning of time? It's infinitely regressing. It's always stepping back and trying to say, well, there must have been something, there must have been something, but never finding something which is the starting point. Same with the spark of life. You know, humans have a conscience, have a sentience, an awareness. Where did that come from? How did that evolve? At what point did bacteria gain sentience? We as humans, in all of our scientific attempts to create life, are unable to have that key, like kick-starting electrical impulse. We think it's, you hear the kind of classic story of Dr. Frankenstein, and it's lightning and all this crazy equipment, isn't it? And it's like all this electricity, and there's this kind of thought, well, it must like require this huge amount of energy and a spark of lightning, and all of a sudden you've got life. That's what science fiction writers did for ages, and that's not the answer, is it? You can't just do that. You can't just provide life. You can't just create sentience unless you're God. And then, well, that's what we're seeing there in letter C. Because we do have an answer, don't we? We read Genesis 1 last week. We read that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And for the Lord, you know, a day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is as a day. The Lord doesn't regard time in the same way that we do. And I mean, if you look at how we understand time, how do we understand time? Typically, it's by the rising and setting of the sun. If you want to go on a more technical level, the way we are able to perceive time is through change. As different chemical reactions happen, things change in the world, and so we perceive time. What happened when there was nothing physical? When the Lord was there? We say in the beginning, but the Lord simply doesn't have the same relationship to time that we do. And so he's not bounded by this idea of what came before. Because he is the Lord, and he is. When he cites his own name, he says, "Tell them I am has sent you. I am who I am." There is no before. There is no need to ask any questions further than that. He is the Lord. He doesn't play by the same rules. And of course, that's fine, because he is the Lord. Secondly, then, so that's the first one. Worldview cannot infinitely regress. It has to have a starting point. We have a starting point. On Sparks of Life as well. Of course, we read last week as well. The Lord created man and woman. He gave them life. He breathed life into them. So there we have answers for those two things. A worldview must be able to explain the big three. This is the big three we were talking about last week. You need to have answers for metaphysics, what is real. You need to have answers for epistemology, what is true. You need to have answers for ethics, what is right. Those are like the big three pillars we looked at last week. And we need to have an answer for that. And very simply, if you have no answers about something, how can you be said to know what that thing is? If somebody approaches you and starts a conversation with you and you say, so what's your name? And they're like, oh, I don't know. And you say, okay, well, do you work? Where do you live? Where are you from? I don't know. I don't know what I do for work. I don't know these things about myself. And truly, it's like, well, do you know anything about yourself? And if that is the case, we can't get to know them. They don't know themselves. What are we even to say of this person? Nothing can be said for certain if they do not have the answers about themselves. And in secularism, I will say, to the credit of some of those worldviews, they are two-thirds of the way there. Two-thirds of the way there. Three big pillars: reality, truth, and morality. Metaphysics, epistemology, ethics. So you look at, for example, the very hardcore scientific worldview, and it has a suggested answer for metaphysics, because it says we came about by evolution and the Big Bang and by this incredibly long process. Now, we don't think it's a satisfying answer, but it is an answer. And then they have epistemology, what is true, and they say, well, because of reality and the progress of things, we say, well, look to science. We can observe what is true. Out of that, we can see what we believe to be true. So we're saying, okay, we don't think this is satisfying, but at least you've got an answer. And then we get to the third one. What are your ethics? What's your moral grounding? What does your worldview completely out of science and observation grant you for ethics? Nothing. How are there any ethics if everything is random? If it was created in the Big Bang? If things have emerged out of the random collision of particles, and you're a subject to the whims of the universe and random chance and all of those things I studied in physics, if that is the guiding force of your life, why does any of it matter? Why wouldn't you just do what you feel is best for you and other people? Who cares? You know, where are the ethics? We do not have a solid system of ethics there. On the other side of the secular arguments, what we have now, that's maybe a modern view, this is what we would call a postmodern view, is the kind of, oh, well, I'm living my truth, and we're all doing what we feel, and everything's connected, and there's like a general spirituality to that. And there is an ethics there, right? There is an ethics of we want to have this big kind of really tolerant, loving conglomeration type thing. And again, we have this through the connectedness side. Maybe you have a metaphysics of, oh, it's all real because of the connectedness of everything and this kind of the faux spirituality that comes in. That is maybe, again, it's not a satisfying one, but it's one that could be argued. And then the third pillar, epistemology. What is truth? You don't have one. Because the only truth is your truth. And if the only truth is your truth, then there is no objective truth. There is no truth. And I would say that's the one more so that we need to consider. Because that's the one that's coming to the forefront more so in the world we live in now. And then Christianity, well, again, we covered this last week. We have the whole picture. We have the God who created, the God who sustains. We have the God who is truth and gives truth. And we have the God who loves and asks that we love because of his character. Number three, a worldview cannot be arbitrary. Arbitrary. So the example I'm thinking of for this, those two simple words, but why? How many children do you know? How many small children do you know? How many children who hear something and say, but why? Why? And then you give the answer for that, and then it's, but why? Do you know, and there's this constant pressure on you as an adult to be able to justify everything. But that's a good response, because a child's mind wants to see that there is truth behind something. Things can't be arbitrary. And I would say, in the secular worldview, this is where maybe it falls down with parents and children, because a child will ask, well, why? Why do I need to do this? And the parents will say, because I told you so. And that's not really a satisfying answer, is it? Because it's like, okay, so if the child was a philosopher, he might say, well, what is the grounds for authority as a parent? Why am I subject to that authority? All this kind of stuff. But it's an arbitrary answer, isn't it? It doesn't really have a proper grounded reason. It's just, well, because, just because. That's the way things are. That's what we turn to often, isn't it? Traditionalism. It's because that's the way things are and have been. And to go outside of that makes it very uncomfortable, because then we actually have to question the value and truth of things. It's just easier to do things the way they have been. So secularism, then, it is that instinct of going with the gut. You ask people questions about, say it is about morality. You know, why do you think that is wrong? Why do you think I'm blanking here on examples, but you ask on a moral issue and you say, why do you have a problem with that? And very often you'll get the answer, well, I don't know, just because. I don't know, it just seems right. It's how I feel about that thing, and that's the reason I have for it. And you're saying, well, that's not a good enough reason. You don't have an answer. And I think this, for most people we encounter, this is the big one, I think, as I perceive the conversations I have. Because most people, the average person on the street, has not thought enough about why they believe what they believe. It just comes to them from the world. It kind of like seeps in, and they're just like, yeah, sure, I'll believe that. I haven't really thought too deeply about it, but there's something in me that, because I see how other people live and because I see, because I have my emotions, those are enough to justify the way I act, the way I think. But what is the reason? A very simple question. And it tears those things apart. Why do you believe that? Why do you believe that? And unless there is a solid answer, that worldview's fallen apart. What about us? Well, this point leads us to Christ, doesn't it? Because all that we have, all that we believe, all that we speak, is to point to Christ. It is to be a reflection of God's love as we walk alongside other people. It is to be the glory of God. All is being spoken and given by God for his glory. The reason we know it's right is because God has revealed his character through created order. You long, this average person on the street, you long for goodness and truth and love and justice because God created us in his image with a fundamental desire for those things. Sin has twisted that, but in Christ, we can find our way back to the truth. So when that question happens, this is the inroads. This is the evangelical opportunity. When somebody says, they comments on morality or whatever it is, and we ask the question, why, and they're unable to give an answer, we say, well, friend, I have the answers you're looking for. Christ has shown us. God has revealed it. There is a reason for everything we believe, and a lot of what you believe, inadvertently or not, comes from that. So let me show you the truth. That's our inroads. And lastly, a worldview must be consistent. Cross-examining the world. That's the term we use when a lawyer stands in front of a witness, isn't it? You cross-examine the witness. So, well, what does that word mean, cross-examine? Well, you examine the facts over here, and you examine the facts over here, and then what you do is you bring those two together and you cross-examine them. Do they fit together? Mr. Witness, sir, you said the suspect left the venue at 8 p.m., but we knew that the venue closes at 7:30. How is this true? And then it comes out maybe there's been a lie or a some kind of confusion over the truth. That's how our legal proceedings work. The truth is cross-examined to see if all of the different viewpoints, all of the different witnesses, all of the different evidence fits together into a consistent whole. Because if it doesn't, then we have to ask, is what we're hearing really the truth? A worldview must be consistent. And in secularism, we have a worldview at war. And it's at the fringes often, but it is at war. The example I often think of when I think of like a worldview falling apart in modern society is the distance between radical feminists and transgender men who have called themselves transgender. Because the whole thing of radical feminism, valuing the experience of women and validating what it means to be a woman, which we affirm in some ways, not quite radical feminists, but we appreciate that kind of like the desire to value what it is womanhood. But at its radical end, it's saying the only way you can ever understand what a woman goes through is to live through her experience. You cannot be a woman without having that lived through experience. But what does the other side of things say in transgender activism? It says, well, a man doesn't have to have that experience. A man can just become a woman. And those two things clash. Popular author J.K. Rowling, known for the Harry Potter series, she has become cancelled, is the term in culture, because on Twitter all the time she is advocating radical feminism. And it's there's just like a term for it, it's like TERFs, and it's like it's radical feminists who specifically degrade the transgender movement. And she's been completely lambasted because the culture's at a point now where we have to choose one of those things because they don't work together. They don't work together. And so we're rejecting one and accepting the other. But both of them are consistent with the worldview of living your own truth, right? It's what we call cognitive dissonance in a worldview. Cognitive dissonance is when there are two things you believe that do not work together, and yet you let them sit in there happily alongside one another. Cognitive dissonance. So that's like tolerance. We believe that there should be toleration for everyone, but we don't believe we should be tolerant of these people. Well, those two things clash, don't they? That's inconsistency. A man whose integrity I admire, even if I think his morality is completely corrupt, is a man called Peter Singer. I don't know if you've heard of Peter Singer. He's an Australian philosopher who is what we call a utilitarian. And utilitarianism is the philosophy that the best thing to do is the thing which achieves the most good for the most people. You know, it's like if you have the option to save one person or 1,000, if you have the option to kill one person, take his organs and save 8 people, well, that's the right thing to do, isn't it? That's kind of the extreme end of utilitarianism. And Peter Singer is a radical utilitarian. And following his worldview to the consistent end point of science is to say, and this is what he espouses, is that humans and animals have no objective difference in value. If we're following what secularism believes, that's where we land, isn't it? What is it that gives human beings value? We say it's because they are created in God's image. What does society say? Well, they're created as randomly as one another. So why is the life of a human any more valuable than the life of an animal? And then he goes down, I'll read you a quotation here. Listen to this. Singer is famous, or infamous, for denying any moral distinction between animals and human beings. Between animals and human beings, for example. And he grounds rights in the capacity to feel pleasure and pain and develop preferences on their basis. Okay, so that's where our morality comes from. Can they feel pleasure? Can they feel pain? Can they develop preferences to distinguish how they want to see that fulfilled? So this implies, back to the quotation, that infanticide of severely disabled newborns is acceptable. Not just abortion, but infanticide of severely disabled newborns is acceptable, but factory farming and experimentation that causes pain to animals is not. And it says, Singer is a hero to those who champion animal rights,
but widely despised by disability rights activists. And we look at that and we think, horrific. Isn't morality horrific? But do you know what it is? It's consistent. That's the horrifying thing. If we follow that abortion mindset to its conclusion, we say we have no rights to life as human beings over animals. Where do we look for value? Why don't we just kill the elderly and the disabled and the young when they aren't convenient to us? That's what seems to fit the narrative, and it does. That is consistent, but it is horrific. And when I say a worldview at war, it's because different places in the secular culture are horrified by this, but can't really give an explanation to why they're horrified. But with Christianity, we have got consistency. Now, while we disagree on the exact workings out of some things, we're not always all on the same page on everything. But as to the core tenets of Christianity and our ethics and our truth and our reality, those main foundations have been here for thousands of years because they are true. The Word of God endures forever. There's a picture, I don't know if you've seen it, but it's basically all the books of the Bible in a line across the bottom, and then lines drawn marking every time that the Bible references itself and provides consistency among itself, and it just forms this complete mass of color, and it, like, the design of it forms a rainbow. But it's this really beautiful thing to say. The Bible is consistent right through. What does Jesus do? He fulfills the law and the prophets. What does he do on the road to Emmaus? Well, beginning with Moses and the prophets, he shows everything about himself in the scriptures to those disciples. It is consistent from beginning through to end. And that is a beautiful thing. So those are the four big flaws. Worldview cannot infinitely regress. A worldview must be able to explain the big three. A worldview cannot be arbitrary, and a worldview must be consistent. The secular worldview does not hold its ground on these things. Christianity, our Lord Jesus.